Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington, D.C.
And I think about over $2 billion been planned to ensure that that is actually addressed in terms of raising finance to support the operation.
Regional leaders in West Africa meet in the Nigerian capital Abuja Sunday.
We rejected the result. We will not recognize them because they are fabricated, they are fake.
Mauritania's main opposition reject the result of last week's presidential election.
Had a temporary withdrawal of that case, and we're going to be now, by virtue of that, lodging a case on steroids.
And South Africa's opposition Nkonto Wesizwe party says it plans to soon launch a fresh legal challenge over the outcome of the May 29 national elections. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. In the Gambia, a member of parliament is expressing disappointment after the ECOWAS parliament declined to help establish a regional court to prosecute former President Yahya Jammeh and others accused of human rights violations. Yahya Sanyang says victims of human rights abuses and violations that happened over two decades of rule by Jammeh need justice. His remarks come after a majority of legislators from the ECOWAS parliament voted against playing a key role in a proposal by legislators from the Gambia to establish a special tribunal. They urged the country to use its constitution and other legal processes to establish its own court to address the issues. For more reaction, I reach Gambian parliamentarian Yahya Sanyang.
A bill was introduced before the National Assembly on special accountability mechanism. Part of this was for ECOWAS to help Gambia set up a tribunal that is going to be composed of ECOWAS judges and Gambian judges. We already enacted this as a law for ECOWAS to come and help us to prosecute Jammeh. Because we felt that we don't have the capacity. The crimes committed are so enormous that we don't have local instruments to take care of those kind of crimes. So we thought that probably bringing ECOWAS on board is going to help us to have to build capacity for this special tribunal. But I had, unfortunately, ECOWAS parliamentarians rejected that law enacted by Gambian parliamentarians, which is very unfortunate.
But the ECOWAS suggestion is that it cannot be a referee and it cannot be a prosecutor and a referee at the same time. If something were to go wrong in the Gambia, it would have to come back to quench the fire.
What is going to go wrong? They did in Senegal. It was former president somewhere was prosecuted in Senegal successfully. I don't know whether ECOWAS took part in that prosecution, but I can tell you it's never going to be a problem.
Are you therefore saying that the decision not to be involved in setting up this regional tribunal was an error by ECOWAS parliamentarians when they voted on this?
It was a great error. I don't know whether the case was not, because that is why I'm trying to call the Gambian parliamentarians in the ECOWAS. We have five parliamentarians in the ECOWAS. I call them and I want to know how do they put this case to ECOWAS parliamentarians? How do they defend this? Because for me personally, if I was there and I put this case before the ECOWAS parliamentarian and I defend it with an attitude, I'm sure they will be able to see something. So now I'm trying to wonder, how do our parliamentarians in the ECOWAS defend this proposal to ECOWAS parliament?
What happens to the law now? Does it render it ineffective in the Gambia?
Of course, because for me, when this happened yesterday, why will we enact a law without putting all of this in the first place? Because if we knew ECOWAS is going to be part of this, we could have consulted the consent of ECOWAS, the commission. We are doing A, B, and C. Are you guys going to help us prosecute Jammeh? Are you going to provide us with court facilities? Court facilities, this I mean by way of judges. But we went ahead and enacted a law, and we know it's the law. We cannot be the only country to implement the law. How dare we bring that law before the National Assembly to be enacted, only for the law to become effective because ECOWAS reject the proposal?
Does that mean that you have to go back to the drawing board? Parliamentarians would have to go back to the drawing board in order to rectify this?
Well, I'm sure the content of the law was a very progressive law. Now, the only avenue that National Assembly can do is to their parliamentary procedure will have something like reintroduce whatever is rejected. So now we only have to talk to our parliamentarians who are defending or who are representing the interests of Gambia in ECOWAS Parliament. It can also be state to state. It can also, the president and this minister of justice can also start lobbying to make sure that this law become a law to be able to prosecute effectively and immediately Gambia era crimes.
Neighboring country Liberia, the president has signed an executive order to have a war and economic crimes court to prosecute those who were alleged perpetrators of the civil wars and impunity in the country. Will you consider having such a thing?
For me, anything that is going to provide justice on the table, anything that is going to make victims get justice, I am in for that. But as I said, our Gambian context, Gambia is a very small and closed society. Sometimes if you want judges to perform effectively, I'm not saying that our local judges are biased or they are not competent, but for the fact that the society is very close and small, if you bring foreign judges to be able to prosecute some of these crimes, in my opinion, it's going to be more effective that way. By way of that, our judges are human. They may have sympathy on certain things. They may have sympathy for certain people. But a foreign judge who has never seen the face of these victims, who has never had any interaction with these victim families, I'm sure we'll better deliver justice more and more effectively for that matter.
Yaya Sanyang is a member of the Gambian Parliament. He spoke with me from the capital, Banjul. The regional coordinator for the Central Africa, the Institute for Security Studies in Senegal, says countries with military leaders in West Africa are likely to return to the regional bloc ECOWAS in the future. Dr. Oluwole Ojewale says he expects West African leaders to review their strategy to engage the junta leaders in the region. His comments come after junta leaders in Niger, Mali and Burkina Faso signed a confederation treaty on Saturday. The move, observers say, is to move away from ECOWAS, which had called on them to return to the group. It also comes as West African leaders meet in Nigeria's capital, Abuja, Sunday. For analysis and the latest development, I reach Dr. Oluwole Ojewale.
I think they are bent on ensuring that the fracture ECOWAS, and the recent move has come to cement that action. So we can hope in the days to come that ECOWAS might have to rethink its approach, whether it will continue to keep their bureaucrats, their bureaucrats within the ECOWAS, whether it will continue to also sustain all the multilateral treaties of movement of goods, movement of persons, and other related issues that they enjoy with the countries and which the three countries also enjoy within the ECOWAS. So these are things that I think are going to redefine future relations among the other ECOWAS, the 12 ECOWAS countries and the three that have created an alliance of Sahel states now. But I also think it's a very bad dent on ECOWAS. They will have to continue to look for diplomatic options to bring them back. But let me talk in terms of the long term. These countries are coming back to ECOWAS. I can't tell how long it's going to be, but the moment in which they possibly democratize, they will have to come back to ECOWAS. This is just a military strategy of creating isolationist parallel organization in terms of the AES alliance, but they are definitely coming back.
The ECOWAS leaders are meeting in Nigeria on Sunday. It's a usual heads of state summit, but do you think
the leaders will take a look again at their major concerns and why ECOWAS, they said, has not been involved in the fight against jihadists that they frequently face.
Well, I think it's a two-way thing. One, ECOWAS has made a move in the recent time by setting aside a plan to develop a what they call a standby force, ECOWAS or standby force. And I think about over $2 billion been planned to ensure that that is actually addressed in terms of raising finance to support the operation. But you cannot shape a man's head when the man is not there. These are the same people that are not on the table. And the extent to which they don't come around, it becomes a bit difficult to be able to fashion how ECOWAS is going to design their counterterrorism engagement with the absence of these countries on the table of ECOWAS. So those are the critical issues that I think will shape the future relation. But the meeting of ECOWAS is definitely going to address and think about how they have actually mastered their diplomatic engagement with these countries in an attempt to bring them back in the past few months now. I think that is also going to be part of what this head of state will be deliberating on when they meet in Abuja.
The school of thought suggests that perhaps the ECOWAS' decision to push hard for them to return to democratic rule and its political stance of zero tolerance for military or forceful overthrow of legitimately elected government appears to have rubbed the junta leaders in the wrong way, which might have helped them to unite in this front and try to get away from ECOWAS. Your thoughts?
Well, with profound respect to the people that hold those views, the reason why the people want to leave ECOWAS is to ensure that ECOWAS does not micromanage or interfere in their democratic transition. For instance, in Burkina Faso, the fellow there has said, micromanage a transition plan that makes him to stay in power till 2029. So ECOWAS has no say in that. The moment they are able to perfect those plans, they will definitely retrace their step back to ECOWAS, because that's the only demo. They will not remain perpetually as a military authoritarian regime. So the conversation about, and now that ECOWAS have even suspended and removed all these sanctions, so those things are already in the backside of history. They are no longer on the front burner. The important thing is that these people want to micromanage their own transition process and ensure that no external body can interfere with what they want eventually. And I think that is what they are achieving now by staying away from ECOWAS and make sure that they perfect that plan before they begin to think about their reapproachment to ECOWAS.
Dr. Oluwole Ojewale is Regional Coordinator for Central Africa at the Institute for Security Studies in Senegal. He spoke with me from the Senegalese capital, Dakar.
As journalists continue to report on complex and difficult topics, including conflict and human suffering, studies like the one done by the Harvard Kennedy School indicate it's increasingly exposing them to trauma and affecting their mental health. On this week's edition of Our Voices, we will explore how mental health is discussed in the media and why female journalists are at a higher risk. Join the conversation Wednesdays at 1900 UTC on The Voice of America.
In Mauritania, the campaign team of the main opposition leader is rejecting the outcome of last Saturday's presidential election, saying it did not reflect the will of the people. Bakary Tandia, the executive director of the Council of Presidents of the Anti-System Coalition, says the election results were rigged. It comes after the Constitutional Council confirmed the outcome of the poll announced by the Electoral Commission, or CNE. It showed incumbent President Mohamed Ould Ghazouani won with 56.12% of the vote, while main opposition leader Biram Da Abaid, an anti-slavery activist, came in second with 22.14%. Islamist candidate Hamadi Ould Seed El Mokhtar came in third with 12.8%. Bakary Tandia, the executive director of the Council of Presidents of the Anti-System Coalition, tells me that the opposition has resolved not to accept the outcome of the polls.
Far from reflecting, you know, the reality, anyone who has closely followed the elections, the mobilization, and the way people voted, and the expectation, the result published don't reflect, you know, the reality. There is, even, you know, under the normal circumstances, with seven candidates based on the political landscape of Mauritania, there is no way any candidate could win in the first, you know, round. So that's why we rejected the, you know, the results. We will not recognize them because they are fabricated, they are fake.
But the Constitutional Council on Thursday confirmed President Oguzwani's re-election bid with the figures submitted by the CNE or the Electoral Commission, saying that he legitimately won the election with 56.12%.
So we know that the Constitutional Court will never make any decision that will contradict, you know, the will of the ruling party. And it's the same thing for, you know, the National Electoral, you know, Commission. The, you know, the anti-system opposition is not represented. We have no one representing us.
But you knew you knew this was the situation before you decided to compete in the election. So why complain after the fact?
We complain before it. We advocate for change. They made promises they did not, you know, respect. But based on, you know, our strategy, we know, despite all the barriers I just, you know, listed, we still, because, you know, people are so committed to change, you know, the situation, we knew despite that we had the possibility to win. And we did.
You did not launch any appeals within the stipulated time frame after the results were announced to legally challenge the outcome of the election. So if you fail to meet the parameters set aside to challenge the election results, then you have obviously accepted in spite of your rejection.
No, that, you know, that is not the case. We intentionally refuse to legally challenge because it doesn't make sense. In 2019, we, you know, tried to follow the law. It did not work. So we are still analyzing the data we have, you know, we have collected, and based on that, based on the projections, you know, we know that we won the election. I would give you, you know, one example. In my area, you know, for instance, out of 46 polling, you know, station, we, you know, we won 45. And, you know, in other areas, like, you know, Gidimaka and other regions, you know, almost in the all major cities, we won. So that's why, you know, the ruling party, the government, became very, very nervous.
So what is the next line of action for the main opposition?
The next line of action, this afternoon we have a special meeting to discuss about, you know, some strategies, and also to try to build a larger, you know, coalition to put more pressure. We are not going to recognize fake, you know, results. That, you know, we have decided that.
Bakare Tandia is the executive director of the Council of Presidents of the Anti-System Coalition. He spoke with me from the Mauritanian capital, Nouakchott. In South Africa, the spokesperson for the opposition in Nkonto Wesizwe, or MK Party, says it plans to soon launch a fresh legal challenge over the outcome of the May 29 national elections. Citing voter irregularities and rigging, Lamolo Ndlela also says the MK Party has uncovered new evidence that backs its claim that the polls lacked transparency and credibility. The opposition party claims the votes were rigged, alleging that over 9.3 million votes were unaccounted for. But critics say this is yet another attempt by former President Jacob Zuma-led party to seek relevance, an accusation Lela denies. For more information about the opposition party's plans to seek a fresh legal challenge, I reached Lamolo Lela, spokesperson for the MK party.
We took the matter to the electoral court. They responded by way of and responding affidavits. And in there, we picked up a number of very interesting matters and issues that they raise, which effectively triggered us to change our strategy in terms of how we approach the case. So we had a temporary withdrawal of that case. We're going to be now, by virtue of that, lodging a case on steroids with additional evidence that continues to come through. Remember, we have a team that is actively investigating and working throughout every single day, every single process, every single province and voting district to ascertain exactly where the discrepancies are and gain as much evidence and collect as much evidence as possible.
And Lela, the MK has been alleging or claiming that 9.3 million votes were unaccounted for. But some South Africans are dismissing this outright, that you don't have any empirical proof to support this claim.
Why the rush? In the same way that the IEC, when they declared their results, you know, speedily so and in a rush, we asked the same question, why the rush? Why must we be rushed to lodging a case? I mean, these are elections, you're talking over millions of votes, and this is a process. So we used the objections that we submitted to the IEC at that point in time, plus additional evidence when we made the case. Certain other evidence we presented in court. But why must we be rushed in terms of how we present and told how we should present and how much evidence we should present? No. So we're not going to be rushed. So, if that's what people think, let them continue to think so. But let them wait until we get to court.
What do you say to those who are of the opinion that this claim is just to tarnish the reputation of the IEC, the Electoral Commission, and by extension, the South African Coalition, the Government of National Unity, because your agents were present at the various polling stations when these results were compiled, tabulated, ascertained, and certified before being announced? So how do you come back and say it was rigged with no evidence? They claim that this is just a publicity stunt to draw attention to the MK party.
Exactly. How would we go about, you know, saying that elections are rigged without any evidence? I mean, who said there's no evidence? Where are they getting that from? Where would you be getting that from to say there's no evidence? I mean, I've just continuously said that we submitted evidence. The mere fact that the IEC can say, based on the evidence that they've received from MK, they believe, you know, it's not substantive. That's them. So would they be able to say that if there was no evidence presented? They're not the court. So people can go and say that we don't have evidence. Well, what are they talking about? Do they even understand what the evidence is? And on top of that, they cannot come and tell us, based on your comment now, that we had, you know, agents at every single voting district. Do you know that there was a voting district, particularly in KZN, where we got, just off the back of our slips, 100% win rate, 2,800 votes. You know what was registered in the system? Zero for that particular voting district. Does that not raise flags for you? So what do they mean that we had agents there when the numbers don't correlate, the numbers don't tally? A voting district where we had 2,800 votes. We've got the receipts. We've got the slips. But what is input in the system is zero. What does that tell you? So are you still telling me that there's no rigging here?
So the IAC, or for that matter, South Africans, should be ready for the MK to present its case to court soon?
We're doing so expeditiously, of course. And also, one thing I need to touch on. The IEC has got no credibility whatsoever. These are people that, off the back of close to 500 objections, still went ahead and announced that they were going to declare results the following day, off the backdrop of objections that were submitted as per Section 55, which means you have to go and submit an affidavit and then raise that to the police and then make that submit that affidavit accordingly. We followed the process, but they still went ahead and announced in a rush when they still had an additional 3 days. That's why President Zuma then said, why the rush?
Lamolo Ndlela is the spokesperson for the Mkhonto weSizwe or MK party. He spoke with me from Johannesburg, South Africa. In Kenya, a lawyer and political analyst says the decision to establish a task force to audit the country's public debt is crucial and necessary. Javas Bigambo also says the audit will let Kenyans know how much the country owes and actions successive governments have taken to service the loans. He adds that it will be the first time such an inquiry has been carried out after the East African nation gained independence. His remarks come after the Law Society of Kenya announced Saturday that its members will not participate in the debt audit task force established by President William Ruto. The organization, however, called on the National Treasury to work with the Auditor General, the office mandated by the Constitution to carry out the proposed task of auditing the public debt. An audit of the public debt is one of the major demands of the Gen Z protesters who came out against the finance bill. For analysis and more about the latest development, I reached lawyer Javas Bigambo.
A critical step in the right direction for Kenyans to get to appreciate or to know what is the exact status of the country's debt, what kind of debts, how much has been paid so far, what debts remain unpaid, what interests have been paid, what interests remain unpaid. And so I think the decision is very crucial because the issue of the country's debts has been very interesting and curious because Kenyans have never generally known if debts are taken or loans are borrowed, what exactly are intended for those loans, how much of those loans taken have actually been directed to those particular projects that were levied or intended for those loans. So this audit for Kenya's debts will provide an accurate data or information for purposes of knowing if at all any debts that have been taken or loans have been taken have been actually utilized for the intended purposes and to what extent and how effectively Kenya is diligent in meeting or paying its debts.
Don't you think with such significance, yes, the Law Society of Kenya should be, yes, an integral member or an integral part of this to ascertain what the issue is with the debt?
Exactly. And that's why in the gazettement that was rendered yesterday by the president of the Law Society of Kenya, Faith Odhiambo, was gazetted. However, there is still a challenge as to the extent of the legality of that gazette notice because, like I said earlier, or I intimated earlier, the Attorney General and the Auditor General were not party or have not been included amongst that task force. So there is a bit of a challenge there. So far as we are speaking, the President of the Law Society of Kenya, Faith Odhiambo, has been gazetted as a member of the task force by the President.
What do you think of the suggestion that the Gen Zs will
I think the issue of establishing a task force is a justiciable issue. Secondly, it does not quench the thirst of the Gen Z on issues to do with the economic status of the country because the Gen Z and the issues of demonstrations and protests were not directly linked or tethered to the issues of the Finance Bill 2024, but they were inclined perpendicularly to issues to do with the economy of the country. And that's why the issues to do with the proposed tax levies or the proposed tax regime would have scaled up the cost of living in the country, hence the economic question. So the Finance Bill 2024 was merely a trigger factor. It was not the primary issue for the demonstrations.
What do you think will happen next after the audit is complete and the status of Kenya's
The audit will be complete in 3 months. That's the subsistence of the Gazette notice. 3 months. But the issue here is that once the task force concludes its report, its investigations or inquiry, and then hands the report of its inquiry and findings to the president, the findings of that report will be a critical juncture and opportunity for the country to start discourse, national discourse, on the status, state, and future of debt and debt management for the country. Secondly, the issue to do with the debt audit does not necessarily mean that the issues of the economy have been properly handled, but the findings will provide insights on how we can balance our sheets, the budget sheets, with regard to the country's budget, the deficit, and the necessity of living within our means as a country.
Javas Bigambo is a Kenyan lawyer and political analyst. He spoke with me from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi. Still in Kenya, President William Ruto has ordered significant cuts in the federal budget and other government reforms to pay off a crushing debt burden. The move is seen as a concession to popular disapproval of a tax bill that sparked weeks of violent protests. VOA's Nairobi Bureau Chief Mariama Diallo reports.
Following weeks of protest, during which dozens of people were reportedly killed, Kenya President William Ruto withdrew a finance bill intended to raise $2.7 billion in revenues, most of it from tax increases, to pay off debts, and announced a compromise. Speaking to The Nation Friday, Ruto said the new plan is to cut $1.39 billion from the budget and borrowing the difference. To make it work, Ruto said his government has taken actions with immediate effect.
47 state corporations with overlapping and duplicating functions will be dissolved. The decision to fill the position of cabinet of chief administrative secretaries is hereby suspended. The number of advisors in government shall be reduced by 50% within the public service with immediate effect. Budget lines providing for the operations of the office of the First Lady, the spouse of the Deputy President, and the Prime Cabinet Secretary will be removed.
And there's more.
Public servants who attain the retirement age of 60 shall be required to immediately proceed on retirement with no extensions. The purchase of new motor vehicles by the government is suspended for 12 months, except for security agencies. All non-essential travel by state and public officers is hereby suspended.
Some of the actions were on a list of demands by protesters. Ruto also says that he has appointed an independent task force to carry out a comprehensive forensic audit over the country's public debt.
This audit will provide the people of Kenya with clarity on the extent and nature of our debt, how public resources have been expended, and will also recommend proposals for managing our public debt in a manner that is sustainable and does not burden future generations.
Nearly 40 people have died and 360 people have been injured nationwide since the protests started 3 weeks ago, according to Kenya National Commission on Human Rights. Mariama Diallo, VOA News, Nairobi.
This is The Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs, and music from African Collection. But first, now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. Regrettably, many of the media houses in the African continent do not have correspondents dedicated to analysis of economic and financial situation. As a result, the education of the people on economic matters is rather low. And this may explain why many Africans have followed the narrative by Western analysts about the economic and financial situation in Africa. Most of these analyses point out that the poor economic performance of Africa is massively, mostly due to rampant corruption, ostentatious behavior of government officials and legislators, and a good deal of incompetence. All of these might be true, but they do not amount to the fundamental problem of the economic and financial situation in Africa. Almost all the African states have signed on to the Bretton Woods Institution, meaning the World Bank and the IMF. That means they are bound by what is usually called the Washington Consensus, or to follow the macroeconomic stability of the IMF. Macroeconomic stability means that African states must balance their expenditure with their revenue. And many experts will tell you that one of the problems of Africa is that the governments have difficulties in raising revenues. This is not surprising, because for you to raise taxes, you have to be industrialized and you must have workers, not just with minimum pay, but good working wages, more than a living one. And this is at the present time not true for Africa. So when you also look at situation with individual African states, if you take Kenya, when they go to the IMF, IMF will send an expert team to Kenya, and they will go through meticulously the projected expenditure of the government. And when they found out that there is a major gap between the expenditure and the revenue, then there are problems. The reason is that it's so difficult to get Africans to pay taxes. This is not new. Everywhere in the world, people don't like to pay taxes, but they cannot afford to pay higher taxes. And when the IMF experts find out that the revenue is low, they will ask the government whether they have any donor prepared to give support, budgetary support. In many cases, yes, there are donors that will give budgetary support, say, for education or for health. But if this is not the case, the IMF will insist that they raise taxes. This must have been what the government of Kenya went through, and they were told you must raise taxes to balance your budget in confirmation of the macroeconomic stability. As you know, there have been many problems of demonstration in Kenya for the financial legislation. They couldn't accept it, the people, because really it is too much of a burden on them. In the end, the president decided to abandon it and ask the legislature to work with him to put it aside. Now, when that is done, there is a problem, because the IMF was able to agree with the government of Kenya that for them to have what is called a program with the IMF, they must balance the budget. And since they have abandoned the financial legislation which would have balanced it, they have to go back to the issue of budgetary consideration. And that explains why the government of President Ruto decided to go on this austerity program. Of course, all austerity programs, whether by developing countries or satellite countries, are very painful. And this one, announced by President Ruto on Friday, is going to cause a lot of problems. But this is the nature of austerity problem. It is whether you are in Europe, America, they're painful. And if you look at what's happening in Argentina, yeah, you have a president who from the outset said we are going to have austerity. And this has caused havoc in Argentina, because the president said he wants to bring down inflation. And even before the Kenyan demonstration, there were more violent demonstrations and deaths in Argentina. But in Argentina, people understand the nature of the financial and economic program. And their complaint is that the new government should abandon the programs. So the difference between Africa and Argentina. So we will see what the end will be. But there is really no choice for the government of President Ruto to resort to austerity to meet macroeconomic stability. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect a flashback with music from the continent. Body and soul to this. My heart to this.
in that moment, nothing in life is promised except death. We had the opportunity to play this game of life. We need to appreciate every moment.
I sacrificed my appetite for my little boy. I took a wrong turn, but I just want to make it right. I'm a man of my own, chasing my goals. I know like palabra, leave me alone. A mind on his own, a mind on his own. If I talk, I'm a mistake, you hurt me. If you hurt too, will you please forgive me? I didn't mean it, I did it, I did it. Oh my God. Them all be fakes, man, I never fake it, man, I keep it real thing. I was born for this shit, but my clock, them no man, I rule a man for this thing. Can no man fi stop the will of God. This word coming right from my heart.
I do like you, man, too. shiver. Come to me now, aim me my papa. What you want, dress, got to hit the shower. Then do the things we did do for corner. Sense me now, just step on for corner. When I treat your walls, I do pass a coach. Even if she lying, I will still believe her. Now you have fit on a man to say no. And it's far too late, you need to surrender. If you're in a problem, sick of this, say. Like I'm moving your guys. They're gonna be sick of this, say. But that's something about it, I tell. If you're in a problem, sick of this, say. Like I'm moving your ways. They're gonna be sick of this, say. You know that's something about it, I tell.
I'm gonna be sick of sorrow, darling, darling. Show my mommy sorrow to badale. You dey give me oh, mami mami. My mommy cause a calamity. Oh, you dey check a sorrow, darling darling. Show my mommy sorrow to badale. You dey give me oh, mami mami. My mommy cause a calamity. All around the perimeter. No fear, no go leave you japa. Because I know they want another. My baby, you don't draw my attention. Loving on a new dimension. Your body, they draw high attention. Got me screaming, oh, Lord have mercy. I'm going to check a sorrow, darling, darling. Show my mommy sorrow, to badale. You they give me, oh, bami, bami. My mommy cause a calamity. Check a sorrow, darling, darling. Show my mommy sorrow to badale. You dey give me oh, bami, bami. My mommy cause a calamity.
The DJ all day, baby.
Listen, it's RJ. Shut up, Wally. And J. Chameleon. Alongside Modern Heritage. One lady.
You can double it, touch it, pull it again. The way you're dancing, cool, baby, come again. The way you bubbly, baby, and you're whining in the disco. It's like you just won a beauty contest. Yeah. Now in particular, come get me your cellular. So that I call you and we play like fiddler. Automatically, plural, not singular. So beautiful, nobody contest. So yeah.
Ready, 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 ready engine. Yeah, cold, but she used to the freezing. Like a stripper, she used to the teasing. Understand, pleasing, the reason why she give me this feeling.
Tell them I follow me. Said them one join the Saban Academy. They about 35 in a Miami. In a this party, we not pass 45. Now what till I read the girl say?
Boom, 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 boom.
I said the girl say, boom.
So keep on the energy coming. Keep it up, keep it up, keep it up, get it. All sound attack like I'm up here.
That was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here at the English to Africa service of the Voice of America in Washington. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. And as you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, including producer Nicole Peters and engineer Justin Thwaite, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, he who knows not and knows that he knows not is wise and must be helped. But he who knows not, yet knows not that he knows not, is a fool. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.